CliffCentral.com.
All right. Good morning. It is Monday on CliffCentral.com. It's just after 7 o'clock. We want to find out what you are up to this morning and how your weekend was. Let us know. Drop us a comment. I see lots of people talking about this idea of making decisions and going through with it and following through. Obviously, culture shock is huge, says Steph. And living in Europe, the lack of space took ages for me to get used to. Yeah, you know, it's weird. Like, the things that you think are not going to influence or affect you are sometimes not the ones that do. It's a weird thing. Like, I think a lot of people think about the weather when they make a move. A lot of people think about job opportunities. A lot of people think about what kind of school their kid might go to. But for many of us, the biggest shock might be something like what, you know, Steph is saying, a lack of space. Like, you don't have a lot of room in places like Europe. Houses are small. Doors are small. Stairs are small. Everything's little compared to here. And if you're used to South Africa, we've got expanse and like a high, you know, in South Africa, you think about the sky. And I always think we take for granted the fact that in summer, especially, those clouds are just so high up and so far away, and the sky is so blue and so big. And you don't get that in places like London, even in the best of weather. So it's something to think about. And I'm not going to persuade anyone anymore to stay or to go. If you feel that the world is your place to explore and you want to get out there, do it. I don't think anyone should only ever stay in their country, even if you just go and visit other countries. But to be stuck in one place is terrible. Where you don't have options. So there we go. A decision is always hard until it's been made, says Tracy. That's, you know, how many people get stuck in analysis paralysis, even in work? I mean, you think about how many people just go round and round in circles because they're too scared to make a decision in case they make the wrong one. I wonder how many people, if you could measure that, how many people live like that, and how many people are just stuck in this torture of not being able to make a decision.
Sure. Must be a lot of people, actually.
I'm sure it is.
Yeah.
It's sad.
So, all right, let's look at some slightly more optimistic and hilarious things. We've got a couple of headlines we've got to get to as well. But first, I want to talk about this quickly. What would you do if you got paid 286 times your salary? Because this is exactly what happened. this is something from IOL. So, you know, again, who knows whether they're telling the truth here or not, but this is amazing. In Durban, apparently this Chilean man accidentally got paid 286 times his salary in May. He promised to return the money that he was paid, but instead decided to resign from his job, and he just vanished. So the story was written by someone in Durban, but it's actually from Chile. This guy worked for a Consorcio Industrial de Alimentos, which is a company that produces cold meat in Chile. Okay, cold meat like ham and shit. Due to a clerical error, the business paid him $165,398,851 Chilean pesos, which is about 2.9 million rand. 2.9 million rand. So instead of his usual 500,000 pesos, which is about 8,918 rand, surprisingly, before he performed his vanishing act, the man had informed human resources of the mistake in his payment for the month. Upon inspecting their payroll records, they checked it out and they saw, oh, hell, this guy was given 286 times his wage. And following this, they contacted the employee and asked him to return the money. But he decided, nah, it'll just disappear. So he went to his local bank, and he drew the money, and then he left.
Yeah, you've got to work out, I mean, how many more days did he have to work to get that money? And then you realize it's probably worth just taking it and going.
Well, 286 times his salary means that he would have worked for another 286 months in order to earn that money. And that's a damn huge space of time. I mean, that would be another 23 years.
Jeez.
He would have had to work 23 more years. So, yes, that's when you grab the cash and you make a dash. Talk about, now that guy didn't have to think too much about emigrating, because I guarantee he's not in Chile anymore.
That's true. That is, you'll sign me up. If I got paid 286 times my salary, y'all ain't never seen me again. I'm disappearing so fast.
Yeah.
So fast. I'm changing my name. My name is now going to be Timba.
Yeah.
Somewhere in Mozambique.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be the last you hear of me.
Right. Absolutely.
Sure.
I've asked this.
But do you live with the guilt forever?
But you just heard what Dr. Hanan said about guilt.
I know.
Commit to the idea and get on with it. You heard what he said. So let me ask you both this. We discussed this probably years ago. But if you had to like make a run for it and leave South Africa and go and start new, but because they were chasing you down, so you'd go to a country where it might not be where you have connections or any of that stuff. It's just to get away. If you had to run away, you said Mozambique now, Mash. Where would you go,
yes, Leanne,
if you got paid 286 times your salary and needed to gap it?
I have to stick to my guns and say the Algarve in Portugal, to some really tiny fishing village where you kind of pull your chairs out of your apartment and sit on the pavement in the afternoon to listen to the neighbors argue and to see who's coming home with how much fish, what their days were like, who's having affairs.
Yeah.
Just watch the world go by.
Where would you go, Mash? Mozambique, is that your first port of call? Because it would be easy to get in and out, right?
Yeah, Mozambique is where I'm going to run away from. So I would actually end up in somewhere in Poland.
Poland?
Yes.
What the hell would you want to do in Poland? I'd rather go to Mozambique.
It's a beautiful country. The springs are beautiful. The lakes there. Oh, it's a beautiful country. And it is so semi-secluded. So it's easy to actually completely disconnect from the world that side.
Maybe. I still reckon that the best places to go are like tropical places. Because you're going to have good weather all year round. You're going to be able to sit on the beach. I don't want to be in a civilized first world place either where they can track me down. You want to be in like Guatemala or in Panama or in Jamaica. You want to be somewhere along the equator. You want to be in the Caribbean or you want to be in Central Africa. Because I think if you've got enough money, you can really make a nice life for yourself in those places. And you're very isolated, but then people can come and visit you, I suppose, as long as they keep it on the DL.
Hey, people can forget about me. But, either way, it's just
Poland,
a secluded place, no cameras.
I can't believe you'd want to go in Poland. Go to Poland. That's crazy.
Poland is a beautiful country, Gareth. It is stunning.
I reckon, look, even in South Africa, there are places you could probably hide away. Our crooks hide in broad daylight. Our crooks, the politicians, they keep doing their jobs. So, I mean, in this country, you could get away with anything. But there are parts of South Africa where I think you could hide quite well. You know, little towns in the Karoo. No one's going to come looking for you there.
Yeah.
No, people do. I mean, I stayed in a little town in the Karoo. I lived there.
Mm.
And, you sit around that little pub in the village and you look around and you think, I wonder how many people have run away from something.
Yeah.
And I remember at one stage a radio station came in this like mobile OB van and did a number of shows from the area, and people didn't turn up because they're hiding from something. They don't want to be seen or spoken to or recognized. Right.
When you say running away, it might not be from criminal things. It might be from a crazy ex. It might be from, I don't know.
Absolutely.
Maybe they've just decided to start their life anew. And this is all part of the conversation that Ali started with us with Dr. Hanan earlier. But imagine how exciting it must be when you don't have an option. Like you've got it. You've fully committed to the idea because there just isn't. There's no turning back, right? You get in your car or you get on a plane or whatever and you just go with a suitcase. That's all you've got. And you have to start from scratch.
That sounds really exciting.
Sounds very appealing.
It's exciting, right? I mean, it's like a part of me goes, whoo, that would be amazing. Anyway, I mean, Congo Chris says you can go to the Scottish Isles. They will pay you to go and live there. It's just so shit so much of the year, really. Marco says Portugal's stunning, but he also likes the idea of Poland. So between you two could each How's Marco for a while in UMash in Poland and Leanne in the Algarve in Portugal. Silicide says, go to Home Affairs, get a new ID, move to Lichtenberg, isolated and boring as heck. Lichtenberg.
Really?
Jesus. Yeah, there are parts of South Africa that even if I was being hunted down by the police, I wouldn't move to. There's some place.
Yeah, like Kuruman.
He's going to look for you in Putaditaba, you know?
No, exactly.
Hebolien. My hometown.
Oh, is it really?
Yes, it is.
Out of all the places in South Africa, I guessed your hometown.
Yeah, there we go.
Could it be a place to hide, do you think?
No, you can't hide there. It's actually really popping there. There's lots of events there, I'm not defending it. It is very popping. Lots of celebrities come down there. Even that naked hike is there. The naked hike. I'm sure you guys have heard about that. It happens in Putaditjhaba. Lots of events happen in Putaditjhaba. There's lots of huge churches. Those evangelists and all of that like show up on TV.
Right.
So it's really popping there. You can't hide there. You can't.
Oh.
But you can hide in Kuruman.
It's important news. Kuruman, eh?
Yeah.
Well, all right. So there's a place not to go to. Now we know. So tick that one off. Also, I think in a big city, it's probably hard. It's easier to hide than in a little town. So maybe we're actually being counterintuitive here. And the real thing that you should do is go to the busiest places you can find, because then you can just mix into the crowd and no one will ever know you're there.
Yeah, you can hide in plain sight.
Makes a lot of sense. I don't know. I mean, we always play the game with the zombie apocalypse. It's like, what would your first move be if suddenly everybody started turning into zombies? And half of the people say, get out of town, because those people will become zombies and they become more dangerous. And the other half are like, no, stay where the resources are. I don't know the difference. To me, I think I'd prefer to be where there are less people, because I always think people are more dangerous than zombies. And the more people you have around you, the larger your chances are of being picked off, you know.
That is true, yeah. In such cases, in these apocalyptic events. The biggest threat is other people who are not the zombies. So you'd want to stay away from them more than anything, actually.
Yeah.
Just to save yourself, yeah.
Well, I mean, let's all stop fantasizing about that stuff now, because nobody can go anywhere in the dark, and with load shedding, you'll only be able to move around. It's almost like we've gone back to, like, primitive man, where your body is now, if it's dark, I must sleep. You know, you're, like, completely controlled by your circadian rhythms.
Yeah. That's true. That is absolutely true. But, I had trouble sleeping last night, main reason being... Yesterday was quite ridiculous. After my date yesterday, I actually went for a walk because I came home and I realized that I went on another date yesterday. But that's not the point. The point is I went for a walk. I got home. There was no electricity. So I was like, let me go for a walk quickly. Go up the street. Come back home. I see red lights. And I'm like, okay, what's going on? Because I see lights by my complex. And it's an ambulance. And I walk to the complex. I start talking to the security guards because I'm really nosy. So I start asking them, what's going on exactly? What happened here? And the security guard tells me that, geez, dude, a child fell from the fifth floor.
Oh my God.
Shit.
Yes. A child fell from the fifth floor and I was just so traumed. So I ask him, okay, so what exactly happened? Where's the child? Are they okay? Are they? And he's like, of course the child's not okay. But they are alive. Yeah. And I asked the parents, how did it happen? What's going on? And he tells me that, so the parents actually, parents or guardians, whatever they want to call themselves, but they don't deserve to be called parents at this point. Mm. But they went out on Friday and locked the child inside. And they've been out ever since. They just never came back. So now this poor child, I don't know if they didn't have food or what exactly happened, they just wanted to get out of the house. And then I don't know if they were trying to jump from balcony to balcony or what exactly they were trying to attempt to do. But next thing you know, child falls.
That is awful. What a terrible story. Jesus. I mean, first of all, I thought the story was bad when you said a kid fell from the fifth floor, and it is. But then I got even worse when you said that the parents just basically locked the kid in the apartment and gapped it. What the hell?
And just left. Yeah, they went out drinking or something the whole weekend.
Oh, my Lord.
Yo, there's some terrible people in this world. I feel bad when I leave my dog for like an hour to go to the shops.
Yeah.
You know? How can you be so irresponsible? I mean, we were talking last week this time about the tavern in East London, right? Mm. We were talking about that level of irresponsibility. We have got some of the worst parents in the world here in this country. Really. Like people who just don't give a shit about their responsibilities. They just don't care.
Mm.
By the way, someone's asking, though, Mash, on a much more serious note, did you also go on a date with the waiter from the restaurant who'd saved your ass with the double date?
Was it your third date?
No, this has come on completely different.
You are very obviously highly in demand at the moment for essentially this many dates over one weekend. It's not really fair for the rest of us. Sorry, it's not on. Is it true that you got someone interested in you because Simpiwe shared something on her TikTok, and that's how you ended up getting a follower who wanted to date you? Is that true?
Yes, that is true.
I heard that from somebody told me that.
That is true. And then, me and this person are actually planning on going on a date sometime this week. We did meet last week.
Is this a totally different person? So this would be date number 4 this week, right? This would be the 4th date in a week.
Yes, this would be my 4th date.
Look at you. You are cleaning up. Holy shit. So, you know, everybody says, oh, it's so hard to find a nice partner or an interesting date. Not for you, clearly. You are lining them up.
Leave them for the rest of us.
I will, Leanne. I'll leave y'all crumbs. But it's just a thing of, it's easy to find dates, but it's hard to find a partner.
What are you looking for, though?
Yeah, because my thing is I'm very, I wouldn't say I'm picky. I'm not picky at all. But I have certain boxes that all need to be ticked or else. I am open to compromise. Compromise is great, but you can't compromise on everything is what I'm getting at. You can't compromise on, for example, cleanliness. You can't compromise on, for example, somebody who's actually financially literate and actually understands what makes sense to spend money on and what doesn't make sense to spend money on.
Yeah.
You can't compromise on such things or else you just, it's detrimental to your mental health. You can't be with such a person. So for me, it's just a thing of tick my boxes. And they're not hectic. It's very low level stuff. But not everybody can do that. Hence, I just keep going on dates.
Well, I'm proud of you for doing that. You know, so many people don't even make the effort. They expect like someone amazing to fall into their lap, and they don't even go and meet people. They don't bother to set up dates. They don't bother to have that coffee. You know, it's hard. Like dating requires at least, as Dr. Hanan said earlier, it needs an investment of some of those coins of yours. And if you're not going to go to the trouble of meeting people, then you can't complain when nobody comes your way.
Absolutely. You also have to put yourself out there, you know, whether it's joining apps, dating apps, or even on Instagram, just post some cute pictures, you know, like just take that bra strap to the side a bit. You know what I mean? Yeah.
No, but
if I move my bra straps, all hell will break loose. They have to stay where they are.
No, so Mash, I mean, I'm not being patronizing when I say this. It's a good thing to see someone who's making an effort like this, because then when you do eventually meet someone nice, you've put in the work. You deserve it.
Absolutely.
That's just going to happen. It's not going to fall into your lap.
Yeah. No, absolutely. You have to put yourself out there. There's no other way. In 2022, there's no other way.
Yeah. No, I like that. All right, so we've figured out that Mash is probably the one who gets the most dates out of all of us, and not just on the show, but at Cliff Central in general. By the way, just one quick thing on this, because we mentioned how it's a good idea to go for an afternoon thing, because then you can cut it short if you want to.
Yeah.
Or you can extend it into the night if you want to as well. There are some things that are just a very bad idea, like Friday afternoon lunches, whether it's with clients, whether it's with business colleagues, whether it's with family, friends. Friday lunches are always a terrible idea. If you aren't 100% committed to that, never do the Friday lunch because it always ends up going on late. It becomes many drinks. If you're driving there in your car, it's a disaster. You have to think about these things and plan that well in advance. Just my little
bit
of advice.
And you do get carried away.
Friday's never good for that stuff. Yeah. Because you think, oh, well, it's the weekend now. I don't have to rush back home. I'm enjoying myself. Three drinks become six. You order more food. You're sitting there after the sun's gone down, and you're like, wow, this has been a long lunch. And then before you know it, it's Saturday.
Yeah, next location.
Exactly. So I would say that my bit of advice is try to avoid those lunches on a Friday, even on a Saturday. Friday and Saturday lunches are deadly. Brunch is fine because you can always get away and say, I've got lunch arrangements.
Yeah.
Or you have things to do in the afternoon. But there's some decisions that you can't get out of. Oh, Gary and Sanella are talking here. Gary says, Mash came back to give a proper tip to the waiter. Gary, I see you living up to your name and keeping it clean. I'll make an effort too. Mash must go back and give a tip with a happy ending. Jeez, Mash, they're all climbing into your private life now. You see, you share your stories on this show, and look what happens. Everybody decides they have a right to say something.
Oh, jeez. Proper tip. Oh, I'm traumatized.
No. I think that the one thing that I've also learned out of load shedding in the last while, just to go back to that for a second, is that a braai or a fire doesn't care about Eskom. So if you have a fire, and this obviously counts for everybody because you can make a fire whether you've got lots of money or very little money. You can always buy one of those little braais and make a fire, and that can keep you warm, and you can cook your food on it. It's a good idea. So there's another way we can hopefully make it through what is not going to be a very pleasant time for us, but hopefully not a too long time with this level 6 bullshit, which kicks in today again.
Yeah.
All right. What else have you got on your agenda, Leanne Moll? I know you had a whole bunch of things you wanted to talk about. We've got Collectomania coming up in a little while, by the way, so stick to us for at least another 15 or so minutes, and we've got Collectomania kicking off. What did you want to throw in?
So speaking of moving to the UK, if that's something you were thinking of, this is something that came up that I was very, very surprised about. But apparently used wet wipes have formed an actual island that's changed the course of the Thames River in the UK.
No.
Table.
Yeah. So as much as we think,
is this like that plastic island in the Pacific where all the plastic bottles and plastic bags and plastic bullshit is just all gathered into a big, like, moving mass of pollution?
Pretty much, but this is quite a solid development.
Oh, my God, it's disgusting.
And it's the size of two tennis courts, right?
Jesus.
In the river. And it's called Wet Wipe Island.
Oh, that's disgusting.
It all comes from flushing wet wipes, which we all think are safe to flush, but most of them aren't because they actually contain plastic. So, yeah, your plastic analogy is not far off.
Disgusting. So people just flush these things, and now it's formed an actual island of filth in the middle of the Thames River.
Yeah. Because they don't disintegrate, being plastic. You can actually stand on the island. It's a meter deep or a little bit more in places of just wet wipes. And so now the government's planning on banning certain wet wipes, even the manufacture and sale of them, the ones containing plastic.
Oh, that's so gross.
But, yeah. So it just makes you think, I mean, I'm surprised we don't have issues like that here. I mean, where are our wet wipes going? Is there an island forming somewhere that we don't know about?
Yeah, I don't want to start my Monday by complaining even more. But I've got a river in front of me here. It's basically just like a garbage. What do you call those things? Conveyor belt. It's like a conveyor belt of garbage and just shit. And in fact, now in the middle of winter, it stinks too, because you know what? They pour everything in there people upstream are obviously shitting in the river and God knows what else, but it's just, it's disgusting. I don't think any river in South Africa could be, you can't drink water from any of them, that's for sure.
Yeah, you're certainly not like dipping your mug to have a drink.
I've mentioned this before, if I fell in that river, I would have to go straight to intensive care.
It's probably acidic.
It's so, it's so disgusting, Mash. I don't know how any of the animals, I mean, there's sometimes duck and, you know, like other wild fowl that live on and around the river. And I don't know how they aren't all dead. And supposedly there are even, there's some fish that have managed to live in this river. God alone knows how. But, like, you know, we mustn't point fingers at the UK with their wet wipe island, which is gross. When we've got our own revolting pollution happening all around us. I don't know. I don't know how they're ever going to sort this out, because it's like plastic waste, but it's also stuff that's in the water that you can't do anything about. So I just, I don't know. I really don't think that humans are looking after the earth very well. Tracy says, I never realized you couldn't flush wet wipes until our sewage started pushing back up our toilets. The worst experience. I felt sorry for the plumber who had to fix it. Yeah, it was horrible. Oh, that's so gross.
Sure. And it's a thing of, you think you're the only one when you do it. You think to yourself, ugh, I'm just the only. Yeah, you're like, ugh, everybody knows you don't flush wet wipes, so it's probably just me. We'll make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
But you just added a meterage to the mountain, to the island.
Yeah. A good place for the people who are still crying for the mask to be mandated to move. Yeah. Because these masks are everywhere as well. I don't know if you've seen how much there have been a couple of articles written about mask pollution and how bad that's been. Sebastian says, no one in London wants to end up face down on top of the river.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And there are people who swim in there as well for like exercise and fun.
People.
Oh, this is disgusting. Congo Chris says, a few years ago, they dislodged a one-ton fatberg in the sewers of London a few years back. So that's like an iceberg of fat that was moving through. A big thing, a
probably
ball.
Probably from like cooking.
Ugh, and people's gross bodily. Ugh, it's just. Ugh. All right, we've got to stop.
But it's
this.
Just another example. Yeah, it's another example of how when you throw your. After you cook woks or something, and then you throw the oil down the sink, you don't think of where that goes. What happens to that oil?
Right.
Somewhere down the line, there's a huge fatberg developing in Joburg.
All right. Well, you're going to love Collectomania for this morning. Leanne and I spoke to a guy.
Oh, yes.
This is just the greatest. So we spoke to a guy who collects something that we've never had on the show before. And I'm very excited to bring you the exclusive interview with a man who owns the Poozeum. And this is a Collectomania like you've never seen before. It is time, ladies and gentlemen, for the Poozeum in Collectomania this Monday morning. Aren't you lucky? Here it is. All right. It is time for another episode of Collectomania. And today is going to be one of my favorites. I can just feel it, because this is going to be something which we've never done before. This guy is dubbed the King of Fossilized Feces by the Miami Herald. His name is George Franson. He's soiled his reputation to teach the world about coprolite or fossilized poop. George holds the Guinness World Record for the largest collection of coprolites, over 7,000 specimens, and the largest coprolite by a carnivorous animal, which we'll talk about in a moment or two. In 2014, he used his vast collection to start the world's foremost virtual coprolite resource center. It's called the Poozeum. And the site exhibits scientific research, historical discovery information, news videos, and specimen photographs for comparative analysis. He also loans specimens from his massive collection to museums around the country, that's the US, so that the public can feast their eyes on real fossilized poop and learn why it's so special. George hopes that his passion and his enthusiasm for coprolites will inspire others, including all of us this morning, and especially young people, to immerse themselves in the sciences and in prehistoric history. Now, if that isn't an introduction, I don't know what is. George Franson, what a pleasure to have you on the show. How are you?
Good morning. Good afternoon there. It's a pleasure being here, and thank you so much for having me.
Well, what an honor to have the man who started the Poozeum on our show. I'm trying to contain myself here. But, George, let's just be serious for a second, and then we can get back to the joking in a moment. Coprolites, these are exceedingly rare things, some of them quite valuable, and they tell us an enormous amount about our prehistoric history on planet Earth, don't they?
They absolutely do. First, when you hear about it, it's kind of funny. Some people might think it's really gross that you have, you know, you're a turd collector, and it's I guess it is, but it isn't. These are very old poops that have been mineralized over millions of years, and they hold contents, and they hold the keys to our prehistoric history. When scientists look into coprolites, they can find bits of bones and scales and plant matter that give direct evidence of what that environment looked like millions of years ago. No other fossil does that. So they're like little time capsules that, when we can find them, they tell us a great amount of information about our prehistory. So personally, I think they are the most fascinating of all fossils, and that's why I'm just so passionate about it. And they're funny, and
yeah,
people get a kick out of them. So I think it's a good thing to collect and to share.
I think it's fantastic. You mentioned all the prehistoric information this can give us, but of course there are people in the modern world who also can collect human feces from hundreds, thousands, perhaps even millions of years ago. The original human ancestors tells us about their diet, tells us what kind of lives they led, what their main preoccupations were, how much time they spent getting food, what the variety of that food was. And of course, there are arguments that come into this that are really, really interesting on the cutting edge of science at the moment about how the diet of early humans may have made us cleverer, faster, sharper, better at handling tools. If we hadn't had all of that stuff, we'd be swinging from the trees still. And obviously, these are things that quite seriously need to be investigated. So poo can be very serious.
No, absolutely. There's a famous human poop in London. It's called the England, I'm sorry. It's called the Lloyds Bank Coprolite. It's an old Viking turd. And they've done studies on it, and they've learned that, these Viking people had a lot of grain, but they ate a lot of meat that was infested with parasites. And they can actually identify the parasites of the time and what these Vikings were ingesting and what was in their system. It's fascinating. It was actually insured for, I think, $30,000 or something.
Wow.
You wouldn't want to be in a cubicle next to a Viking who's taking a dump, right?
No. No, you probably wouldn't want to share food after this, knowing what they're digesting. No.
Well, if you think about it, though, I mean, you're talking about dinosaur turds, and this is really amazing because we don't know, for example, there's still a hot debate about which dinosaurs had feathers, whether or not they were more like reptiles, the saurischians, there are all these different family derivations which we're only just starting to discover now. In fact, if they had to remake those early textbooks that we all learned from, they'd probably say that a lot of the dinosaurs didn't look very much like we saw them in those early textbooks. And part of that research comes from looking at what their diet was. And part of that research comes from very, very well-preserved fossils, which are exceedingly rare and which are hard to find. And if you do find them, can be sold for quite a lot of money, and for collectors like you, it's a very, very busy and creative endeavor.
Yes, absolutely. Coprolites are fairly rare, and they weren't really a thing to paleontologists till fairly recently, I'd say the last 25 years. Nobody really collected them. Nobody was really looking at them. They were after the sexy fossils, the skulls, the giant dinosaur. They wanted to find the biggest dinosaur. They wanted to find the most ferocious theropod. They wanted that kind of stuff. Big teeth, unique attributes of the body. Yeah. They wanted to name dinosaurs. No paleontologist. There was one. There's only one that I can think of that was, set their reputation out to find fossilized poop and to study it. Interestingly enough, there was kind of a lost period because Back in the 1820s, Mary Anning, and she's the one that, you know, she sells seashells by seashore, that poem. She was the one who found coprolites back in the 1820s. And she says, I think these are poops from prehistoric creatures. And
she could have made more if she had sold the coprolites instead of just the seashells.
Absolutely. Maybe she missed one there. And so she shared it with the scientific community, and they were a thing back in the 1820s and 1830s, and there were studies. And then it kind of died for a bit, all the way up until the 1990s. They weren't really a thing.
So how did your interest start, and how did you start your collection? Were you a kid? Did it happen much later on in adult life? How did it begin?
That's a great question. So I grew up in the western United States in a state called Utah, which is filled with all kinds of neat prehistoric stuff. We have old rocks. We have fossils of dinosaurs. We have time periods from older than dinosaurs. You can find trilobites and stuff. So as a young person, we'd go out and look for fossils and hike around, and it just became a kind of a passion of mine to study dinosaurs. And every young kid, I think, goes through a phase where they really love dinosaurs. So I took that first year of college. I was in a paleontology class, and I was getting more interested in it, and ended up going to a rock and fossil shop that had something, and it said coprolite on it. It looked like a turd, and I asked the guy at the shop, hey, you know, what is this? And he said, oh, it's a coprolite. And I get that. What is it? So I had never, in all my years, heard of one, because no children's books, no young youth books about dinosaurs talk about turds at the time. And he said, oh, it's a fossilized poop. I was like, no. I couldn't believe it. I was shocked. And it was $20. And back then, this was 25 years ago, it was $20, and still is, a lot of money. And I bought it and I took it. I thought it was the most amazing thing. I wanted to share it with everybody. And they thought it was neat and amazing. And so I worked with my professor and other people in the department there to learn more about coprolites and where they can be found in that area. And I set out to teach myself about coprolites and go look for coprolites. And then it was about the same time eBay started really becoming big. And so I was able to connect with people who were selling coprolites from all over the world. So I'd find them, I'd sell them, I'd network with people. And one turned into a couple dozen fairly quickly. And, you know, after about 10 years, I had maybe a couple hundred, a few hundred. And then it just really started, my network really started to build from all over the world. And, you know, I got better. And I also got progressively better jobs where I had a little more money to spend on these things. And it just grew. And then
over 7,000 specimens, including the largest carnivorous coprolite, or the coprolite of a carnivorous animal. Tell us about that, because that's a Guinness World Record holder. That must be your prized possession in your collection.
Yes, that's so I have the world's largest fossilized poop. It is from South Dakota, and it is Cretaceous, so it's just over 65 million years old. And it's about 26, 27 inches long and about 7 inches wide. And it is filled with little bone bits. And we know it's from a Tyrannosaurus rex, because there are no other identified dinosaurs of that time and of that space that could have made such a large poop that obviously was from a carnivore, because it's got all the bone bits through it.
Yours, Leah.
No, but I was thinking, if you found a whole bird type dinosaur in there, you'd know that it hadn't gone through the digestive system, but it had died as a result of the impact of the poop.
Yes, it was. It smashed right into it.
Yeah.
Well, that is quite wild. I mean, listen, you're really in the life and times of the Tyrannosaurus Rex when you're in its turd. That to me is way more interesting than just the fossilized arm of, you know, of a Tyrannosaurus Rex. Now, you've got a skull in the background there. What is that of, and is it a real fossil or is it just a replica?
Oh, so that's some decor. That is a replica of a small T-Rex. So I love T-Rex.
Oh, wow.
And so this is a small skull. I have a full replica skeleton in my dining room.
Wow.
Kind of crazy.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah,
and what is that? What is that? It looks like a fish. What is that fish on top of the bookshelf behind you?
It looks like a fish. It is a dragon. It is an antique wood-carved dragon from Southeast Asia.
Okay, so it's not a fossil of any kind.
No, there's some, right, let's see if I can find, there's some turds right in there that just haven't found a home yet.
That's so great. And George, but you have to have a sense of humor about this, right? Because everybody else says, oh, this guy collects turds. But I mean, if you took it super, super seriously and you had no sense of humor about it, you'd go crazy eventually because people are like, ha, ha, ha. They don't take it seriously, so why should you?
No, a lot of people don't take it seriously, and they give me a hard time. They make a lot of jokes, but which is fine because you know what? They're talking about it. It's interesting, and
yeah.
I don't care. It's my thing. It's interesting to me. And after the Puseum got out, I know the traffic the Puseum gets and. You know, from Guinness and everything else, there are a lot of people out in the world who also find it interesting. And that's who it's for. You can't make everybody happy. You can't make everybody believe.
Right.
They are what they are. There's a lot of doubters that think there's just regular stones. And that's fine. They're welcome to come check it out and learn. But
yeah.
It's not going to be any chip off my back
Is the Puseum open to, like, people can walk in, they can make a booking, they can come and see your collection? I mean, how accessible is it? Because you also have to be careful. You know, you can't have people dropping the stuff and breaking it. You can't have them stealing your stuff. You've got to actually keep an eye because some of this must be quite valuable.
Yes. So I have a series of pieces that travel in an exhibit. And right now it's at the Orlando Science Center. It's part of an exhibit. It's very cool where the public can go to this museum and see the most coprolites they've ever seen in their whole life all in one place. They can see Barnum, the world's hoops. They can see all kinds of different stuff and learn about coprolites. And what I do is I donate that. I share it with these museums as long as they say, hey, we want to host it, and we will keep it safe and insure it. And
right.
They pay for the cost of getting it there. I'll share it with them for free because I think it's when you have a collection like this, it's very important to share it with those who are interested, share it with the public. And, you know, I've had a lot of scientists, paleontologists reach out who are working on a paper, who have questions. It's open to them. There's a lot of specimens online that they can see. If anybody sees one, they say, hey, I really have more questions, or can we meet to talk about it, or can I see it? I'm very, you know, willing to work something out so that can happen.
Your back door's always open.
Sorry, Leanne, what did you want to say?
I got that. That's good.
Never mind, Gareth. What I wanted to ask was, though, transporting the stuff all over, obviously it gets onto planes, and have you ever had to explain to someone, or do you just say it's a coprolite and they think, oh, well, it's some scientific thing? Or, I mean, I don't know if they'd be that happy knowing that you were transporting poop all over, right?
No, I've been stopped a few times going through airports, so I keep them in these very nice padded boxes, these travel cases. And of course, sometimes the x-rays, they don't know what I'm traveling. It's an odd case. So one of the security people always wanting to open it up, and they're like, what is this? And I'm like, well, they're fossils. They're fossilized poop. And depending on the person, it's a really neat reaction or a really poor reaction. And then, you know, sometimes if it's not a great reaction, I go for additional screening. So it's part of what happens when you're in the business of poop.
You mentioned insurance, and that's an interesting side of this. Have you actually had the collection valued? Do you know what it's worth? And how do you go about insuring a coprolite?
Oh, that was the most interesting feat ever. So after I acquired Barnum, the T-Rex poop in 2020, you know, it's of course very valuable. It was certified by Guinness World Records. So I had to get it insured. So I went to a few of the big clearinghouses for priceless objects, you could say. Like, hey, I want to get this insured. And trust me, when you go to a place like that and say you want to get a poop insured that's normally doing fine art and coins and things like that, the reaction is kind of unique. So lots of times I'll say, I just got a lot of rejections. No, this is not something we're interested in. We're not going to do it. Keep looking. Maybe they'd give a recommendation. And it took a year of going to all these different places. And finally, they said, well, we might do it, but you need an appraisal. You need an official appraisal. All right, great. I didn't really think it through. So then you do the same thing all over. You go and to all these appraisers. Some of them are in the same places, and like Lloyd's and Sotheby's and whatnot. And you say, hey, I want this appraised. And there's nothing else like it. So there's nothing to compare it to give a proper appraisal. I finally, after many, many emails and many, many rejections, which I'm used to in this, and it's fine, I found a guy who was actually hired by the U.S. government to appraise a collection of somebody who was being, was going through some court cases with the U.S. government about fossils. So he had the background of appraising unique and big fossil collections. So he did appraise Barnum, and once I had that, I was able to go to the insurance companies and shop it around and get insurance on Barnum.
What kind of insurance do you have to take out on a turd?
Like how much?
Well, yeah, I mean, he's probably your most, listen to me, it is probably the most valuable piece in your collection, and it certainly would be more valuable than anything that we dig up in our backyards. I mean, it's rare, it's enormous, it's hugely research and scientifically famous and important. So what kind of price would that fetch on the open market? And by the way, how did you acquire it? You just kind of breezed past that, but where would someone even go to acquire something like this?
It's all about networking. So there was a private rancher up in South Dakota who came across it. There was a middleman that I knew who got it from him, you know, talked to him, said, hey, I know a guy. He contacted me and said, hey, I've got this. Are you interested? I said, possibly I need to get it, you know, I need to look at it. It'll probably need to be tested and whatnot. And everything worked out. So I picked it up, and something like this, I give you a ballpark, approximately 20,000 US.
Wow. Holy, holy shit, and, literally. That's phenomenal.
Yes. And it may go for much, much more. I would never sell it, but, you know, if something ever happens to me and my family gets rid of it to, you know, pay for all my poo debts, you know, it may go for less. Who knows?
George, this is an amazing thing. I mean, first of all, you know, your collection has scientific merit. A lot of the people we've spoken to on Collectomania, they just like collecting things. But your interest does not stretch beyond the world of fossilized poop, right? I mean, you're not collecting like more recent specimens, and you're not particularly interested in modern animals and their turds. Or am I wrong?
No, I'm actually kind of a germphobe when it comes to stuff like that. 10,000 years is the cutoff for me. There are some kind of turds in Florida that are questionable. And you know, a few thousand years old. They're just not mineralized. They're kind of chalky, and that's a little scary to me. So they get thrown back. You really have to make sure they're mineralized, they are stone, before they come into the collection. In feces of modern animals, because it tells us something about prehistoric animals. So I do study it. I am interested in, you know, what current animal poop looks like. What does a crocodile poop look like? What does like an ostrich poop look like? You know, things that maybe we can draw reference to prehistoric past with. However, it's all photographs and, you know, online research and libraries. It's not, hey, look, this was outside, bringing it in to put into a case.
Tell me, what other kind of interesting coprolites do you have there which you can actually associate with a particular species of dinosaur or prehistoric animal? I mean, which ones are you most interested in? Do you, for example, have like saber-toothed tiger turds, or do you have something from a triceratops or something from a brontosaurus? I mean, how big, by the way, would a brontosaurus's turd be? That's quite a scary idea. I often joke because I park my car at my parents' house. There's a big tree above the car. And for some reason, these birds all seem to shit in enormous quantities all over my car. And I always joke that it must be a pterodactyl that lives in the tree. Now, I mean, is it true that a brontosaurus would have made enormous big turds? And do you have one of those?
I don't have a brontosaurus turd. It's interesting. There's been studies about brontosaurus turds. You get these giant dinosaurs, and when they poop, it's got a long way to fall, right, unless they poop into the water. Yeah. And so a lot of them scatter. You wouldn't get this nice, beautiful turd shape. You'd get maybe like a cow patty. You know, it looks like a big round
I'm
blob.
Just trying to imagine, like, if you were unfortunate enough to be walking behind a brontosaurus who had diarrhea, I mean, you could be killed by the impact. Leanne joked earlier, but you probably, the quantity and the height that it's dropped from, it could be quite deadly if a human was around at that time.
There was a guy at a zoo who got stuck under elephant poop and died. No. He suffocated.
Really?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. He couldn't get up.
I think he could be dangerous. But as far as my favorite, so there's all different kinds of fossilized poop that are interesting, but some of my favorite are ones with bite marks. So these are poops that were made by some prehistoric critter. A lot of them are probably crocodilian of some sort. And they're floating through the water. And some fish or some other critter thinks it's a meal. They smell it, and they think it's a meal. And they come up and take a bite out of it and learn that it's like, oh, that was not a nice meal. And they release it, and they go about their day. Well, they leave very distinct bite marks on these feces that turn into coprolites. I have one, it's about the size of a little pie, you know, one of those little fruit pies you get.
Yeah.
And it's like the critter went and just took a, if you took a bite out of it without pulling the piece off, and it has perfect teeth marks, upper and bottom bite mark impressions, where you can see every tooth, top and bottom. And somehow in the whole process, it didn't fall apart, and it is one solid piece. That's just the thought of it.
You could then
happen is fascinating.
If you were a great paleontologist, you could probably piece together the jaw of that particular creature and figure out what it was. I mean, this is a whole other, you know, private investigation, sci-fi, historical research project, which I'm sure there are lots of people who'd be interested in. I love the fact that you are one of the few collectors we've had on the show who can also actually send like your traveling collection to museums and for research purposes to other people's offices and labs all over the world. I mean, that's really, really interesting stuff. What do your family think of this, though, and your friends?
Well, I have a very supporting wife. You know, she doesn't care. Sometimes she'll come home and there's turds on the table. Some people might care about that. She's very supportive, and you know, she knows it was one of my things when we met. So that's great. Family's supportive, and friends, they're also supportive. Everybody in my circle, they know about it, and they help me out with it whenever they're able to. So it's nice to have that that network to lean on.
Do you get to display all of this stuff, or is it mostly locked away, and are there specific conditions under which you need to lock it up? I mean, is it any of it sensitive to light or to air or to certain chemicals? I mean, you have to keep special precautions when you store these things.
Yes, I do. So every piece is photographed and it is logged, all the information about that piece, where it was found, size, weight, age, is recorded into a database. So I have this TERD database, a Dookie database, and then it's bagged, numbered, boxed, and then you can see behind me there's there's one of them behind me. There's another one across the room, same size, that store pieces while they're here before they get shipped out or on display, or they just don't have a home yet.
So I just want to put up the picture for the people who are watching on YouTube. Here is the Guinness World Record. That is, what do you call him? Barnum.
Barnum, yes.
Yeah.
Barnum Brown was the person who found the first Tyrannosaurus Rex. And P.T. Barnum was, of course, the circus showman who was a pretty incredible person. So Barnum, the biggest turd, I thought was an appropriate name.
It's amazing. That's millions of years old, but it looks quite fresh.
Yeah, about just over 65 million years old. Looks kind of like a turd. It's rounded. You can kind of see the layers. You look closely, you'll see little bone bits throughout it. And it's been studied. Do we know the contents of it and what minerals make up that fine turd?
Well, you're a fine collector, and it is a great pleasure and privilege to share this collection of yours with everybody who listens to and watches our show. And I'm really pleased we got to talk to you, George. I'm especially appreciative because I know the time difference. And thank you for sharing your collection. What can I say? It's terrific.
Well, I appreciate it so much. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm a big fan of South Africa and the people there and just the beauty. It's an incredible country, and I'm looking forward to the day I get to come back. So thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.
If any of us happen to find any dinosaur turds lying around, we'll know who to send them to.
Please give me a call. Shoot me some pictures. I actually get emails almost daily for people who have found rocks or something that believe they are fossilized poop. And I try to help
Leanne,
them. Some of them are, some of them aren't.
Leanne, is this motivating you to start your own dinosaur turd collection?
Listen, if there's money in it, I'm after it. I mean, it brings a whole new meaning to rate my poop. You know, it could be worth a lot of money.
It costs you a lot of money to do this collecting. I mean, George has probably spent thousands and thousands of dollars over the years on collecting dinosaur poop.
I've made zero money off of this. I have spent many tens of thousands of dollars on it because it's a passion. Wow. And you gotta follow passions and whatever it takes. So I don't mind spending the money. It makes no difference. I think it's a greater cause than spending it on, I don't know, anything else.
Well, thank you. And I'm always grateful for people like you in the world that are collecting things like this, because one day someone's going to say, if we don't look at that dinosaur turd, we're not going to know the answer to a certain very important question that civilization is dependent on. And who knows that they won't find the answer to that in Barnum, the T-Rex turd. George, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Have a great day. CliffCentral.com.